I'm now going to hand over to Ritika. Many thanks all and enjoy the event. Ritika, over to you.
Hi. So thank you very much for this invitation and opportunity to speak, and especially to Sumi, because I know she's on sabbatical break and yet making time for this. Perhaps for those who study inequality and inequality in India, some of the stuff that I'm going to present is not particularly new or exciting. But I think there is one particular piece of this which definitely needs much more exploration in the Indian context and has not actually got the sort of attention from researchers that it deserves. So just before I move my slide to the next one. Right. So this is the kind of stuff that we all know. You know, the top 1% in India, their income share in 1980 was about 6%, and today it's more than doubled to 22%. As far as the top 10% are concerned, they get 57% of income share, and they have 65% of wealth. Now, in spite of these numbers being thrown at us for a fair number of years, in fact, perhaps a couple of decades at least, somehow, you know, this, as far as policy is concerned, there hasn't really been an attention to the fact that something needs to be done about this. Now, you know, there are these videos based on some research by Brosnan and Dewal, where they found that when two capuchin monkeys are given the same reward, which is a piece of cucumber for a simple task, they both continue to do it. But when one starts giving, getting a grape instead, I'm sure perhaps many of you have seen it, you know, it starts, the other one gets really agitated and starts shaking the cage in which it is housed quite vigorously. In fact, they say that they, in another experiment that they did, they found that after a while, even the monkey who's getting the grape starts refusing it and gets agitated. So there is this sort of innate aversion to inequality. And yet, you know, the, it is quite remarkable that in a country like India, people who have the ability, the social elite, the power elite, they haven't really been moved enough to action as far as policy is concerned. So in this talk, this is another sort of kind of statistic that perhaps is not particularly new, but still it's quite striking when one sees it. So it's just two simple lines. One, the blue one crawling along the bottom is the share of profits in the value added in the manufacturing sector in India. And the orange line is the share of profits. And this is plotted from 1991 till 2016-17. I hope it's sort of obvious what is going on here. So, you know, again, so this is really clear that there's one sector that's getting badly squeezed and another one whose share has been ballooning after crawling around 20% until the early 2000s. It shot up to about 60%. I don't know if my cursor is able to help you see it better. And now it's stabilized at just under 50%. Now, this is just one sort of possibility of the kind of inequality that exists. It's possible that if, you know, labor is also getting some income from capital, then perhaps the fact that the share of labor is so low is not something to worry about necessarily. But if you see in the previous slide, 65% of the wealth is concentrated in the hands of 10%. So I think the problem is quite real. Even though I should say that, you know, Indian data always makes you nervous, especially now. It's always been a very contentious issue, but now it's becoming harder and harder to find data that doesn't cause a controversy, and often for very good reasons. So I, with that caveat, I will still share some of the data points that to me present a pretty alarming picture. Now, in this talk, I'm not really focusing or, you know, taking on this problem of social inequality explicitly. It is very much a very serious issue. And I'll just show you two slides that tell you the kind of, the scale of the problem that we have in India. So this is very old data because the 2021 census did not happen in India. And perhaps with secondary data sets, one could do a more recent bar chart as well. But just starting on the extreme right side, is what you have is the literacy rates for 1991 and 2011. On the extreme right is the one of the most, all the different disadvantages, put together. It's rural, female, scheduled caste, so Dalit girls from the state of Rajasthan, which had amongst the worst outcomes as far as literacy rates are concerned. And so in 1991, what you had there was that their literacy rate was around 6%. At the other extreme, for 1991 again, one of the most privileged categories, urban male in Kerala, it was close to 100%. So you can see the disparity that existed in 1991, ranging from 6% literacy rate for some people to almost universal for others. In 2011, things changed, obviously, and thankfully for the better. And you see a substantial increase across the different categories in the literacy rates. So for little girls in rural Rajasthan, Dalit girls in rural Rajasthan, it crossed 40%. For rural Dalit girls all over India, it was over 50%. And of course, going to the other extreme, you can see that it's close to universal as before. So the disparities have narrowed a little bit, but they're still pretty stark. And in fact, even the more recent data are not throwing a very particularly encouraging figure, especially for the more disadvantaged groups in India. Another chart that is quite telling. Sorry, perhaps it has too much information, but I think it's very interesting work. So this is work by Ashish Gupta and Sudarshanan. What they did is to look at life expectancy by social groups. So something similar to what I've shown in the previous slide. They look at male and female life expectancy. So female life expectancy is in the top panel and male life expectancy is in the bottom panel. This is life expectancy at birth, these two, then at age 15, and then at age 60. We don't have to go through every single one of these. I think the simple point is that while all the social groups that are listed here, scheduled tribes, scheduled castes, Muslims, other black backward classes, and higher castes, all of them have seen an improvement in their life expectancy at all three stages, both male and female. But the fact is that the gains are much higher for the more privileged caste groups, social groups, than for the Adivasis and Dalits especially. Yeah, so the Adivasi and Dalit lines are the brown and the blue lines. But so these are, I mean, all of these things are tied up, but this is not the kind of thing that I'm talking about today. I'm focusing very much on the economic aspects of it. And in fact, even more particularly, I want to focus, I think the interesting part of the talk, which is who is middle class and who is India's middle class? So this is, of course, there's a lot of literature on the definition of middle class, including Atkinson's work and many others. And many people, different people are using different definitions and methods. So amongst economists, income and wealth are often used. But then there's also a fair bit of literature, I think, in sociology, perhaps even in psychology, about what is middle class and its definition. But for me, what's really perplexing is that very often when I talk to friends at in Delhi, for instance, these are people who you know, they speak English. Their default mode of travel is to go by air. They have domestic help, sometimes two or three domestic workers at home, a driver, a gardener, someone to cook and clean, etc. And in spite of all these things, they always describe themselves as, you know, for middle class people like us, they saw that or the other. And this just doesn't sit with the facts as we know them, as far as material well-being in India is concerned. Okay, so these are just some indicators. There's nothing, I mean, it's a bit arbitrary. There's nothing sacrosanct about using these. But I tried looking at a lot of different aspects of middle-class lifestyle, and always the numbers were pretty shocking. So Indian males age 15 to 54 who go to cinema hall at least once a month. This is the latest round of the National Family Health Survey, only 24%. And for women in the same age group, it's only 10%. People with a Netflix subscription or an Amazon account, I mean, the numbers are very hard to get. These are industry numbers that I was able to glean from the internet, and that's absolutely, you know, close to zero. If you look at the people who are flying or taking a flight, again, that kind of data is not very easy to come by, but it's between 3 to 11%. So if you assume that every single passenger is a unique passenger in India, then it would be 11%. Yeah, so the upper limit is 11%. Moreover, as I was saying a little bit earlier, these, you know, amongst my, in my social circle as well, when you talk to people, they think of themselves as middle class. But in fact, according to the latest data that are available, only 6 to 10% Indians speak English. The urban population, the share of the urban population that has shares or has investments in shares, according to the National Sample Survey data set, is around 2%. E-wallets, which are seen as, like, you know, a lot of people now in Delhi think that, you know, using an e-wallet is a universal phenomena. But in 2018, this is post-demonetization, which, you know, demonetization happened in 2016. In spite of the growth that happened in that phase, it was still not captured, at least in the NSS data set. And like I said, there are data issues always that need to be scrutinized further. But I think the point of all of these numbers is that they all are hinting at the fact that these middle class attributes are actually enjoyed or, you know, shared by a very small fraction of Indians. And the other interesting thing that I therefore was trying to do is to sort of document this, you know, is it just an anecdotal thing that all my friends think of themselves as middle class? And I thought, let me try and push that a little bit further. And so I did a survey amongst IIT Delhi, the Indian Institute of Technology Delhi, and the Indian Institute of Management Ahmedabad, where I was for 2 years until 2020. So about 200 odd students in both those places. And I asked them if their families owned a four-wheeler, had an air conditioner, and a toilet linked to a piped sewer line. And of course, in this population, this is a totally random sort of selection of people, what you find is that it's very high. Almost everyone has access to these pretty basic sorts of amenities you would imagine. But if you look at the Indian population, the numbers are very, very small. Sorry, my phone was buzzing. So amongst the Indian population, this is again data from the National Family Health Survey. The proportion who have a four-wheeler is 11%. Just one-third have an air conditioner. So I'm looking at the bottom panel and moving my mouse to help you read the table. And only 20% in urban India have toilets that are linked to a sewage line. And yet when you ask these people to describe themselves as either lower class, middle class, or upper class, they predominantly do describe themselves as middle class. And somehow these two facts don't sit together, right? You can't at the same time be amongst the 10 or 20% who are lucky enough to enjoy these privileges and still think of yourself, you know, still be middle class. So either we need some kind of radical redefinition in economics, at least, of middle class, or there's something wrong with the data, or then there's something wrong with the way Indians are perceiving themselves quite incorrectly. Some Indians, rich Indians, privileged Indians, are misperceiving themselves as middle when they're actually rich or super privileged. What are the consequences of this kind of, you know, why does this misperception matter at all? Why should we be worried if people are actually upper and think of themselves as middle? I think that this has serious consequences for the way we think about policy, the way political pressure is created to bring policy change as far as inequalities in India are concerned. I mean, one obvious consequence is that, you know, the extent of inequality is just not getting acknowledged. If those who are at the top think of themselves as the middle, they have no idea of how long the tail is behind them. And this is just one example of the kind of consequence of this blind spot, this middle class blind spot in India. A policy example. So you have maternity entitlements in India. As with so many other things, it's a two-track system. In the organized sector, the entitlements I would have, for instance, if I were to decide to have a child, would be comparable to, I think, the best in the world. I would get 26 weeks of paid leave for the first two children. In the unorganized sector, which is actually the bulk of where our employment is, the organized sector is pretty small in India, around formal employment is 10%. In the unorganized sector, until 2013, when the National Food Security Act was passed, there was nothing at all, except in one or two states like Tamil Nadu and Odisha, quite interestingly. The National Food Security Act, which is generally sort of associated with the public distribution system in India, which is a subsidized food ration scheme. It also included maternity entitlements, universal maternity entitlements, and it made a provision for 6,000 rupees per child for all women and all children, you know, whether it's the first or the second child, it didn't matter. However, the scheme that would flow from the law didn't actually come until 2017. It's a very long name. It's called the Pradhan Mantri Matru Vandana Yojana, PMMVY. It actually reduced the entitlements to 5,000 rupees and restricted it only to the first living child. And on top of that, there are all kinds of demanding formalities and conditionalities, especially in the form of paperwork. Now, even when the 2017, this whittled down version of maternity entitlements were announced by this government, amongst some sections, some commentators, actually, I mean, they were essentially Modi critics, and they should have indeed criticized the government for reducing the entitlement and restricting it to the first living child. But in fact, their argument was different. They said that this was like giving an incentive to women to have more children by giving cash incentive. And I think what's really interesting is that when this provision of 26 weeks was enhanced in 2017, it was widely welcomed by everyone as, you know, something, you know, that mattered for gender equality, etc. But when it came to poor women, it was not the mainstream reaction, but there was an important voice that also said that this was like going to encourage people to have children. So I think because of this blind spot You do have these kinds of things then percolate into the kinds of discussion, public discussion and debate, which eventually, at least in a democratic setting, is supposed to create some kind of policy action. Another example of that blind spot is this infographic that I pinched off Twitter. I think it's genuine, and I think it did emanate from UNICEF, but I can't be sure because I just took it from Twitter. And so in this graph, if you see, India looks really good, right? I mean, India is comparable to the UK almost. I'm not even sure if the data for UK is correct anymore because things are also not looking great there. But the fact is that 90% of the working population is completely, ignored. It's made invisible by this kind of thing because, this 26-week provision exists for a tiny fraction of the Indian population. Another aspect of this lopsidedness is also visible in the political representation that we are seeing in the country. So again, using national sample survey data, they have an All India Debt and Investment Survey from which this data is taken. So if the average of physical and financial assets in crores of rupees in 2018 was 0.2. Yeah, so this is the All India average. If you look at the people who contested Lok Sabha elections, the general elections in 2019, it was 4 crores, which is 21 times the national average. Amongst those who contested elections, the members of parliament, those who actually went on to become members of parliament, their average physical and financial assets were 21 crore rupees, which is 106 times the national average. And then, of course, right at the top at that time, so this is 2019, now it's Mr. Adani who's become the richest person. But Mr. Ambani at that time, that's the value of his assets. And it's 3.5 lakh times the national average. So basically, all the spaces, and you could do this for bureaucrats, you could do this for university professors. So anyone who counts as power elite, political representatives, lawyers, and so on, I think the picture is pretty similar, that the power elite is sort of pretty disconnected and very far, not necessarily disconnected, but very far from the average population. Another example of all of this is from the pandemic. So these are just some headlines, screenshots of some headlines, where when the lockdown was announced quite hastily in India, which is quite crazy also because we don't really have social security networks like some of the other countries do. What happened is that a lot of the companies started saying that the only way we can survive is by laying off people. So these are just headlines capturing. And the impression that they created was that if we don't do this, we are going to go bust. And so this is kind of like a pressure tactic. I'm sure it's used elsewhere in the world as well, to get some kind of relief from the government and so on. At the same time, so these are data points for the post-pandemic or pre-pandemic and the first year of the pandemic. If you look at the pay ratios, what you find is that they were actually, the corporations were doing really well. So now the Indian government, there's a regulation that requires them to reveal their pay ratios, which is basically the remuneration paid to the top executive as a proportion of what is the median salary of their employees. And these are not workers. They're not shop floor workers. These are just employees, managerial staff, right? So that pay ratio of the top paid to the median, and the median, as you know, is halfway was 581 times, 581 for Jindal, which is one of the biggest steel firms. And I think the highest was 752 for Hero Motor Corporation. Between 2019 and 2020, these pay ratios actually became worse. Yeah, so they were the remuneration of the top paid person grew at while they were presenting a picture of, you know, being badly hit by the pandemic, so much so that they would have to either lay off people or announce salary cuts. And just to put these things in perspective, I think The Guardian at that time had an article about top 100 companies in the UK, where they said that the CEOs of the top 100 were paid a typical worker's annual salary within 33 hours of work. In India, it's similar. Mr. Munjal, who is the, you know, the company with the highest pay ratio in 2019, he earns more than the annual earning of a median employee in half a day. So this is the kind of inequality that you are seeing in a very thin slice of the Indian economy as well, right? So we are not even now going to the middle class. We're just looking, you know, at the top 1% of the top 5%, something like that. And even there, the inequalities are mind-boggling. And all of these basically lead me to the real what is it called? The elephant in the room, which is the problem with taxation in India. There have been many different tax proposals to try to remedy this kind of situation. We don't have wealth tax in the country anymore. It was abolished by this government some years ago. We don't have estate taxes. We don't have inheritance taxes. While, as we have just seen, the potential for raising revenues from the rich are pretty massive. So this was a calculation done by another economist in India. And he said that the combined net worth of these 953 Indians is about 26% of the Indian GDP. And if one were to put a 4% tax on their wealth, a one-time tax, it would raise about 1% of GDP. So this was a proposal made at the time of the lockdown, when this question of where will the money come from was even more heard than is usually the case. Similarly, if you look at other sources of raising revenues in India, like property taxes. In India, we were raising only 0.2% of GDP through property tax, whereas the developing country average is 2%. And actually, this 0.2% has now come down to 0.1%. Another interesting thing which links to the point that I was making earlier about the middle class, the upper classes or the rich thinking of themselves as middle class, is this phenomenon in metros, especially. I don't know if it's true elsewhere, but you know, people park their cars, which are worth quite a lot of money, on the road. Not only residential parking, it's on the road, it's on a public road. Private cars are being parked on public roads, but there is no taxation or no revenue generated from that in most places that I know of. But also these same people where, you know, their cars are worth a few lakh rupees. And when they go to the market, they refuse to pay 30 rupees as parking fee. And I think this kind of mentality is really coming from this kind of blind spot and a lack of appreciation of where the tax revenues are going. But that's for another day. Another common response to, you know, these proposals for taxes in the form of wealth tax or property tax or estate tax And even actually, if you look at Piketty and Shan's work, there is scope for improving our income tax, revenues from income tax as well. They had done an older paper where they compared China and Brazil with India. And what they find is that while in those countries, the income tax base had increased to about 8% or 5% of the population, in India, it was crawling at 2 or 3%. Now it's a bit higher in India. But one of the reasons that the tax base didn't increase in India, in spite of the fact that these were periods of very high growth, GDP growth, is because successive Indian governments would raise the exemption limit year after year. So this fear of the so-called middle class, as far as taxation policies are concerned, is a pretty serious issue. One of the reasons they grudge it so much, I think, is of course the usual thing about corruption and misuse of government revenues, etc. But I also think that there is this element of not appreciating the condition of the rest of the country and the lack of material well-being for so many people and the kind of struggle that they face. One common response, again, from mainstream media to some of these issues is, we have so much wealth in the hands of these rich people and let philanthropy do whatever you wanted government to do because they are going to be able to circumvent all the problems that we face when government tries to provide free schooling or health facilities, etc. So one problem there, of course, is that there is an exaggerated sense of what is the scale of philanthropy in India. For instance, Mr. Munjal's annual remuneration in the pandemic year was 85 crore rupees, and he pledged 100 crores as COVID relief. And this, of course, looks really great when people see it. This is really a fraction of his actual net worth. That's one part of the problem. Another aspect of this, it's not just one data point. There is a report that comes out every year that looks at philanthropic giving in India. So I was able to put together some of these data points for big givers in India. So I think these are the top 10 in 2020. And what you find is their donation as a percentage of their wealth, except for Azim Premji, everyone is less than 1%. And the sometimes there can be fluctuations from year to year. But even the 3%, 3-year average, or 2-year average, sorry, if you look at it, is not particularly impressive. So one is that these donations amount to very little. The philanthropic giving amounts to very little. But more importantly, I think the point is that when the government decides what to spend on, at least there is a pretense of democratic decision-making. When the giving is happening through philanthropic routes, then basically it's the rich people and their selected few who will make these decisions, and that's not particularly democratic. And I also think that there is this problem that they just use it to whitewash their other sins. So it makes them look good and sort of reduce the demands for having a more fair taxation system and allowing the government to carry out its very important role of redistribution in an economy. Somehow the redistributive role of government is very easily forgotten in the Indian case. And I think that one of the reasons why you have that is what I was showing you earlier, which is that a lot of these people are coming from such privileged and rich backgrounds. So in the final section, I think I'm nearly out of time anyway. The final 2 or 3 slides are really about what has happened in the past 2 or 3 years, which I think is pretty worrying in the Indian context, because again, it's a repetition of this pattern, which is that certain things work really well for this thin slice of the Indian population. And then that thin slice basically is perceived as being the entire Indian population. So during the pandemic, everything, educational activities moved online. And because it worked for the privileged who have internet access, who have personal devices, they have two or three personal devices sometimes, they were able to easily make that transition. But for the bulk of Indian children, these 2 years were an absolute nightmare. So I'll give you two sort of insights into that. One is that we had done a survey last year. It was called the school survey in 2021. In August, we did this survey. This was amongst disadvantaged children, mainly Dalit and Adivasi children, and mainly rural, although there was a small urban sample as well. And what we found is that only 24% in urban areas reported that they were able to study regularly online. In urban areas, it was less than 10%. Almost half of them were unable to read very much. And the bulk of the parents felt that their children's reading abilities had declined. Most of them wanted their schools to reopen. But for those, you know, in India, it was so difficult to have schools reopen. It was almost 2 years before they were reopened. And basically what happened is that as it is, learning achievements are very poor in India. But what happened is that a class four child whose learning levels were maybe at class three, at the end of the 2 year lockdown in schools, was promoted to class six. But meanwhile, she had forgotten a little bit of what she already knew, so had declined to class two level. And so now in class six, she's expected to cope with, you know, learning abilities of a class two level without any additional support being provided by the state government or the central government for that matter. And this creates the danger of a lot of these kids dropping out, because when they're in class six and seven, when they go back, and if they're discouraged and they're not able to cope, then, you know, there is a worry that they will drop out of school. And that, like I said, will sow the seeds for future inequalities, because education is so key to social mobility. The other bit of insight I wanted to give, that this is not just about the disadvantaged children that we surveyed during the pandemic last year. Even at IIT Delhi, where I teach, I was actually serving for the past 2 years as Associate Dean for Student Welfare. We had exactly the same issues. Our students were all at home, and I would say between 20 to 30% were unable to study at home, were begging to be brought back because they didn't have devices, they didn't have connectivity, they didn't have money for data, they didn't have a space at home where they could focus and study. There were expectations from the mother, especially from girls, to help out in household tasks and so on. So this is not just about the most underprivileged. IIT does have a fair number of children and a diverse spread of kids. But still, these same problems were also cropping up in India. The other area where, you know, which is a cause of great worry for me, especially since I've been working on Aadhaar and these digital IDs in India, and we've already seen the kind of exclusion they create. These are now being pushed in the healthcare sector. This is super dangerous because not only do they create barriers to access, they also create huge privacy issues and the possibility of people's sensitive health records being shared and being abused for commercial purposes, like health insurance, deciding premiums, etc. So yeah, this is it from me, and I'd love to hear what you think. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Ritika, for your wonderful presentation. I mean, adding so much complexity and a nuance to how not only we study inequality, but also the impact of the kinds of blind spots that we've that policymakers and others have become so used to normalizing. Okay, so now we have about Yeah, we have about 16 minutes or so for Q&A. And I know that there will be some questions taken from the floor, from the people who are in the room. And then, so that's what we'll do. We'll alternate. So we'll take a question from those of you who are present at the LSE, and then we'll take a question which has come to us online in the chat. So, do we have a question from the floor at this time? People at the LSE who are present and have been listening, do you want to ask a question to Ritika? And if you do, do just raise your hands and Peter will come to you. Are there any questions at all?
Yeah, go.
Can I just speak?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not used to this sophisticated microphones. Thanks. Thanks very much for Sumi for the sharing and Ritika for the talk. You gave us a nuanced picture, drawing on various kinds of sources, often from private sector data and so on. In part, I guess, because India hasn't made its national sample survey data public since, I believe, since 2012 or something, which is a remarkable, step back for a country that has a very proud tradition of statistics in the developing world. So my question to Ritika is, how long can they go on doing that? I know there's been a campaign. I've signed things, petitions and things from Indian academics. But how long can that go on? And what are people using? Is the Indian development, there's a development household survey, IHDS, or human development survey, are there alternatives that people are using at the moment? So just a general question on representative sample surveys for India. Thanks.
Should I answer? Do you want to collect some?
I think, Ritika, you should maybe answer this.
Great. Okay. So thank you. This is a favorite topic of mine, the problem and the decay and the purposeful, I would say, attack on India's data infrastructure, statistical infrastructure. The National Sample Survey has not released its consumption expenditure survey for a very long time. But in 2018, the data that I presented on this All India Debt and Investment Survey is an NSS round, and that's from 2018. So some of the smaller surveys are continuing, but the real deal, which is the Consumer Expenditure Survey, I think the last one was 2011-12. In 2017, the data that was released painted a very bad picture. And so they said, no, there was a problem with this. And this is happening not just with National Sample Survey data, which is a very valuable resource for all of us, even though there have been problems with it. But it's also with other data sources. Like now the census hasn't happened. And that's a big blow as well, because, the census affects a lot of policy making, but also research. The GDP growth numbers have become very controversial. And so your question is, how long can it go on? I think this is actually quite dangerous, obviously. I can't predict how long they'll get away with it. I think that this is purposeful to the extent that basically, if the facts are undermined, if the data sources are undermined, then it's my opinion versus your opinion. So I'll give you one small example of this. When all the data sources, different kinds of data sources were suggesting that the GDP, the economic growth was not doing very well, one of the ministers said, hey, but look, on the opening of this particular film, it grossed so many millions of rupees. So surely people are doing really well if they can, go and watch films like this. And so I think that it's really a battle between this opinion and fact-based discourse, or whatever you want to call it. And what the other dangerous thing that fallout of the lack of proper or reliable data sources is that people are being driven to data sets like the CMIE, the Center for Monitoring the Indian Economy. They have the pyramids data set, which a lot of people are using now. And I think that that data, Jean and Anmol, Jean Drezen and Anmol Somanchi have looked at it quite carefully. And what they find is that on very basic descriptives, like, you know, the proportion owning a smartphone or literacy rates, the divergence between the CMIE data and other more reliable sources like the National Family Health Survey or whatever else is available just suggests that the CMIE data is not representative, even though it claims to be representative, and is actually capturing you know, the upper end of the income distribution, but not all of it. So I feel that the pressure to bring back NSS and not undermine it is very important. But given the number of battles that we are fighting at the moment, I don't know where this one will go.
Thank you, Ritika. There is, while we wait for questions from the floor, by which I mean people in the room who are present at the LC, there's a question and a query. And the query is, I'll take the query first, which simply says, awesome presentation, Ritika, of course. And will you be able to give us a link to access to your works and paper presented? Just to say that Ritika's website at IIT Delhi is very extensive, and you could have a look at all the work. But Ritika, would you, if you would make these available, then people at the III would put them on the website. Okay, thank you. And the and there is a question from Umu Wumi saying, I think they are asking about how philanthropy in India is seen. Is it seen primarily in financial terms, also in terms of non-financial sort of voluntary work? I imagine that's what's being asked in the question. Should philanthropists, people who give financial resources, only be the ones considered as, you know, as participating or partaking in philanthropy, or should those or should philanthropy also include labor and services rendered sometimes for free by private and NGOs?
Right. So I think the sort of mainstream understanding is the giving that comes through formal channels such as the corporate social responsibility obligations from the Companies Act, but also over and above that, many people, as I was just showing, are giving more than what they're required to give by the law. This is actually for me the first time that I have been asked to think about the giving of labor and services as philanthropic giving as well. But that's my own ignorance rather than anything else. But I don't think anyone is capturing that at all. There is a very vibrant NGO sector, obviously, and a smaller not-for-profit private sector as well. But I don't think that really gets counted as philanthropic giving in quite the way that is being posed in the chat box.
Okay, thanks, Ritika. Peter, do we have any questions from the audience at the LSC?
Thank you very much for the presentation, ma'am, and thank you to everyone who made this happen. Can I just draw your attention to specifically state programs for poverty alleviation, for example, farm-down waivers, or for example, mandatory like amounts of electricity being given per household? To what extent do you believe these are helpful in mitigating the worst effects of the pandemic and poverty? Or to what extent do you believe that it's merely a sort of vote bank measure?
Before you answer that, Ritika, I want to take one question online because I'm mindful of the time. So we have, Tanya Burkhardt, I saw your hand up. If you wanted to ask Ritika your question, you could do that now. And Ritika, you could take both the questions together. Okay, yes, please, go for it.
Tanya. Yeah, thanks very much, Tanya Burkhardt from the Centre for Analysis of Social Exclusion. Really enjoyed your talk. I wanted to pick up on the part where you were talking about self-perceptions and attitudes towards wealth, because I think there are a lot of echoes with research that have been done in other contexts where it's a common finding that people think that they are much less wealthy in terms of the position in the distribution than they actually are, particularly the rich and the super rich. But I wonder whether the hope that you expressed that simply letting people know more clearly where they actually sit in the distribution and making them appreciate just how wealthy they are in relative terms would bring about a revolution in their willingness to pay tax or to give philanthropically. Because some of the research that I've been involved with Katharina Hecht and Abby Davis, for example, in the UK, suggests that the private accumulation of wealth is partly a response to chronic insecurity, even amongst people who we as social scientists would see as very comfortably off. So perhaps because of the lack of effective guarantees of collective social provision through the welfare state, even the middle classes and those above the middle classes feel insecure and feel that they can't provide for themselves and for their children in a way that they feel is adequate, unless they accumulate really quite astonishing levels of wealth. So for them, it is a source of security, and they feel entirely justified in that accumulation in order to provide for themselves and their families. So simply letting people know, well, actually, you're a lot better off than these other guys here, it seems to me, unfortunately, is unlikely to be sufficient to increase their willingness to pay tax. Instead, there's a kind of vicious cycle element. It seems to me we need to give a more effective universal guarantee of right. security. And on the basis of that security, people may then be able to willing to pay more. But of course, how do you get the revenue in the first place to kickstart right. that process is a very tricky question. Thanks,
Tania. Ritika, can I just kind of intervene here and say that there's a question from Alpa Shah.
Yeah.
So, could you please take three questions and then come back?
Sure, please. Yeah.
I just want to get as many questions in as possible, and we don't have very much time. So go for it, Alpa. Go.
Thanks, Sumi. Thanks so much. And thanks, Ritika, too. Nice to see you here. It's very much just leading on totally from Tania's question to you or Tania's suggestions. What if we take this perception of the middle class seriously? You know, what does it reveal to us, right? And can we start from that kind of perspective rather than say, they're not quite seeing their position in the right way, but if we take seriously what they are feeling, the people that you're speaking to, what does that reveal to us, you know? And I was just had some, I think Tania made some very useful suggestions, but I was also thinking, are they thinking about themselves relatively in relation to, for example, the Ambanis, who mentioned, the Adanis, you know, in which scales, the scales are completely, you know, that's a completely different level, right, to having an AC in your house and having a four-wheel drive vehicle, even if you have free servants, domestic help, you know. We're just talking about completely different scales of income and wealth differences. And so maybe what it's revealing to us is maybe our kind of class categories are inadequate to really thinking about contemporary India. And I was wondering if, you know, what could happen if we did something like, you know, I think Mike's in the room, I can see him somewhere hidden. You know, if we did like the Great British Class Survey, you know, that Mike was for in the UK, if we did it in India and took, you know, more cultural categories seriously, I mean, what would that reveal? How would we go about that? How would caste, which was, you know, like kind of didn't, you know, you talked about it a little bit in relation to Dalits and Adivasis, but how does that get mapped onto class? I mean, what would a great Indian class survey, you know, reveal, which I think might be very, might be very valuable. I guess as an anthropologist, suggesting maybe we take what people are telling you seriously and then think about, you know, what that's showing us about inequality in India that isn't getting revealed through mapping what the current categories we have onto the Indian, contemporary Indian reality. Yeah.
Okay, Ritika, you've got 2 minutes.
Okay. So first, can I say that I'm a big fan of the work at CASE. So I'm really pleased that Tania was able to join. And of course, Alpa also is good to see because I haven't met. Now, I think for me, the main, I'm sorry if I sounded naive enough to you know, as if I was suggesting that if they knew where they were, then they would just happily run to the government to pay their taxes. That's not quite what I had in mind, although I do want to say something on that, on those lines as well. I think for me, the most important thing is to at least have a debate around these issues. And what has happened since I've started talking about this, two very rich Indians, including actually the person who's endowed the chair that I have, it led to a discussion in his own family. And, you know, different people were saying different things. But I've heard that from a bunch of others with whom I've shared some of these thoughts. And so I think for me, the main thing is to at least for them to stop calling themselves middle class and to shame them a little bit, perhaps. But also, and I think that, you know, this vicious circle is really the crux of the matter, that in India, the underprovisioning of universal social services, public services, is far worse than in the UK. I mean, in the UK, things have been sliding for a while, but at least people have seen what it can be. Here, there is a kind of cynicism that we'll never get. It's this, that another world is possible, you know, that thought also doesn't occur to people. It's very hard to explain to people that there could be a good NHS one day if everyone was willing to, you know, cough up the money that is required for it. The other thing that I wanted to say, which is, you know, more less cynical and more naive, perhaps, that during the lockdown in India, it was a pretty shocking few weeks at that time, because the lockdown just happened like that. And within a few days, people were without food. They were stranded in urban areas. And it was really the first time that mainstream Indian media was devoting hours and hours of time, airtime, to showing the plight of, you know, these people who are living in very poor conditions. And the outpouring and the outrage at that time, outpouring of, you know, solidarity and the outrage against that kind of inequality, it was quite remarkable. Like, because for people who work on inequality, we knew that this is what it's like. But there were others who were, you know, as if they had just been parachuted onto another planet. So I think the lack of media attention is also part of this story, because even the media comes from privileged backgrounds, especially caste, which is what Alpa was also talking about, caste backgrounds. They're very rich. All of these things sort of escalate, I mean, map onto each other. I'm not entirely naive. I would prefer the stick approach and get a wealth tax, estate tax, inheritance tax, property tax, parking tax, every tax. And then put pressure on, as well as putting pressure on the government to ramp up its services. And it's something, this is not entirely naive. It has happened in the case of the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act. It has happened to some extent with the National Food Security Act. So these things, they will never be the most popular schemes, but at least if there is a legal provision, then we have a fighting chance to kind of, you know, make it work. And right now there are some states which are showing an interest in universal health services. So yeah, in hope, we soldier on. There was the first question about whether I think of electricity as, you know, being useful or not. That was the first question. There's actually a very vibrant debate right now in India, because the Supreme Court, Court of India, has been asking whether such freebies should be stopped. And actually, I think that a lot of what is called a freebie is in fact actually a redistributive program, because even things like the Employment Guarantee Act and food security and all of these things get clubbed as freebies. There are obviously some which it would have been better if we were not wasting public resources on this. But equally, I would say that we should again talk about the revenue side of the fiscal deficit, not just the expenditure side of it. It's very, in India, basically fiscal deficit only means reduce your expenditures, reduce government expenditures. They don't want to talk about revenues because that means more taxation for the privileged.
Thank you, Ritika. I think we have now pretty much come to the end of our allotted time. Thank you for your talk about, you know, drawing attention to the blind spots and definitions, but also perceptions of who constitutes the middle class, but also the ability, I thought that was fascinating, the ability of the middle class to stand in as the whole of the population, thereby transferring all of the natural resources, not only towards it, but also blocking and obstructing, you know, interventions into addressing social inequality. And I thought that that was really powerful, a powerful sort of message that came from your talk. So it's been a huge pleasure for me to chair today's event. And thank you very much, Ritika, for presenting this seminar. Thank you so much to everyone in the audience, both online and those who came to the LSE to join us. If you'd like to hear more about the LSE III, please visit our website to learn about upcoming events and sign up for the fortnightly newsletter. Until we meet again, thank you and goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.